It is a hard life. The houses are built of logs, dark and smoky within. There will be a crude icon of the Virgin behind a guttering candle. The leg of a pig hung up to cure. A string of drying mushrooms. A bed, a stool, a table. Harsh, brief, poor lives. To these upland woodsmen, the devil is as real as you or I. More so. They have not seen us, nor even know that we exist. But the devil they glimpse often in the graveyards. Those bleak and touching townships of the dead, where the graves are marked with portraits of the deceased in the naïf style, and there are no flowers to put in front of them. No flowers grow there. So they put out small votive offerings, little loaves, sometimes a cake that the bears come lumbering from the margins of the forest to snatch away. At midnight, especially on Walpurgisnacht, the devil holds picnics in the graveyards and invites the witches. Then they dig up fresh corpses and eat them. Anyone will tell you that. Wreaths of garlic on the doors keep out the vampires. A blue-eyed child born feet first on the night of St. John's Eve will have second sight. When they discover a witch, some old woman whose cheeses ripen when her neighbors do not, another old woman whose black cat, oh sinister, follows her about all the time, they strip the crone, search for her marks, for the supernumerary nipple her familiar sucks. They soon find it. Then they stone her to death. Winter and cold weather. Go and visit grandmother, who has been sick. Take her the oatcakes I've baked for her on the hearthstone and a little pot of butter. The good child does as her mother bids. 5 miles trudge through the forest. Do not leave the path because of the bears. The wild boar, the starving wolves. Here, take your father's hunting knife. You know how to use it. The child has a scabby coat of sheepskin to keep out the cold. She knew the forest too well to fear it, for she must always be on her guard. When she heard that freezing howl of a wolf, she dropped her gifts, seized her knife, and turned on the beast. It was a huge one, with red eyes and running, grizzled chops. Any but a mountaineer's child would have died of fright at the sight of it. It went for her throat, as wolves do, but she made a great swipe at it with her father's knife and slashed off its right forepaw. The wolf let out a gulp, almost a sob, when it saw what had happened to it. Wolves are less brave than they seem. It went lolloping off disconsolately between the trees as well as it could on 3 legs, leaving a trail of blood behind it. The child wiped the blade of her knife clean on her apron, wrapped up the wolf's paw in the cloth in which her mother had packed the oatcakes, and went on towards her grandmother's house. Soon it came on to snow so thickly that the path and any footsteps, track or spoor, that might have been upon it were obscured. She found her grandmother was so sick, she had taken to her bed and fallen into a fretful sleep, moaning and shaking, so that the child guessed she had a fever. She felt the forehead. It burned. She shook out the cloth from her basket to use it to make the old woman a cold compress, and the wolf's paw fell to the floor. But it was no longer a wolf's paw. It was a hand, chopped off at the wrist. A hand toughened with work and freckled with old age. There was a wedding ring on the 3rd finger, and a wart on the index finger. By the wart, she knew it for her grandmother's hand. She pulled back the sheet. But the old woman woke up at that, and began to struggle, squawking and shrieking like a thing possessed. But the child was strong, and armed with her father's hunting knife, she managed to hold her grandmother down long enough to see the cause of her fever. There was a bloody stump where her right hand should have been, festering already. The child crossed herself, and cried out so loud that neighbors heard her and come rushing in. They knew the wart on the hand at once, for a witch's nipple. They drove the old woman in her shift as she was, out into the snow with sticks, beating her old carcass as far as the edge of the forest, and pelted her with stones, until she fell down, dead. Now the child lived in her grandmother's house. She prospered.
The Company of Wolves. One beast, and only one, howls in the woods by night. The wolf is carnivore incarnate, and he's as cunning as he is ferocious. Once he's had a taste of flesh, then nothing else will do. At night, the eyes of wolves shine like candle flames, yellowish, reddish, but that is because the pupils of their eyes fatten on darkness and catch the light from your lantern to flash it back to you, red for danger. If a wolf's eyes reflect only moonlight, then they gleam a cold and unnatural green, a mineral, a piercing colour. If the benighted traveller spies those luminous, terrible sequins stitched suddenly on the black thickets, then he knows he must run, if fear has not struck him stock still. But those eyes are all you will be able to glimpse of the forest assassins as they cluster invisibly round your smell of meat as you go through the wood unwisely late. They will be like shadows. They will be like wraiths, grey members of a congregation of nightmare. Hark! His long, wavering howl! An aria of fear made audible. The wolf song is the sound of the rending you will suffer, in itself a murdering. It is winter and cold weather. In this region of mountain and forest, there is now nothing for the wolves to eat. Goats and sheep are locked up in the byre. The deer departed for the remaining pasturage on the southern slopes. Wolves grow lean and famished. There is so little flesh on them that you could count the starveling ribs through their pelts if they gave you time before they pounced. Those slavering jaws, the lolling tongue, the rime of saliva on the grizzled chops, of all the teeming perils of the night and the forest, ghosts, hobgoblins, ogres that grill babies upon gridirons, witches that fatten their captives in cages for cannibal tables, the wolf is worst, for he cannot listen to reason. You are always in danger in the forest, where no people are. Step between the portals of the great pines, where the shaggy branches tangle about you, trapping the unwary traveller in nets, as if the vegetation itself were in a plot with the wolves who live there. As though the wicked trees go fishing on behalf of their friends. Step between the gateposts of the forest with the greatest trepidation and infinite precautions. For if you stray from the path for one instant, the wolves will eat you. They are grey as famine. They are as unkind as plague. The grave-eyed children of the sparse villages always carry knives with them when they go out to tend the little flocks of goats that provide the homesteads with acrid milk and rank, maggoty cheeses. Their knives are half as big as they are. The blades are sharpened daily. But the wolves have ways of arriving at your own hearthside. We try and try, but sometimes we cannot keep them out. There is no winter's night the cottager does not fear to see a lean, grey, famished snout questing under the door. And there was a woman once bitten in her own kitchen as she was straining the macaroni. Fear and flee the wolf, for, worst of all, the wolf may be more than he seems. There was a hunter once near here that trapped a wolf in a pit. This wolf had massacred the sheep and goats, eaten up a mad old man who used to live by himself in a hut halfway up the mountain and sing to Jesus all day. Pounced on a girl looking after the sheep, but she made such a commotion that men came with rifles and scared him away and tried to track him into the forest. But he was cunning and easily gave them the slip. So this hunter dug a pit and put a duck in it for bait. All alive, oh. And he covered the pit with straw smeared with wolf dung.
Quack, quack,
went the duck. And a wolf came slinking out of the forest. A big one. A heavy one. He weighed as much as a grown man, and the straw gave way beneath him. Into the pit he tumbled. The hunter jumped down after him, slit his throat, cut off all his paws for a trophy. And then, no wolf at all lay in front of the hunter, but the bloody trunk of a man, headless, footless, dying, dead. A witch from up the valley once turned an entire wedding party into wolves because the groom had settled on another girl. She used to order them to visit her at night from spite, and they would sit and howl around her cottage for her, serenading her with their misery. Not so very long ago, a young woman in our village married a man who vanished clean away on her wedding night. The bed was made with new sheets, and the bride lay down in it. The groom said he was going out to relieve himself, insisted on it, for the sake of decency, and she drew the coverlet up to her chin, and she lay there. And she waited, and she waited, and then she waited again. Surely he's been gone a long time. Until she jumps up in bed and shrieks to hear a howling coming on the wind from the forest. That long-drawn, wavering howl has, for all its fearful resonance, some inherent sadness in it, as if the beasts would love to be less beastly if only they knew how, and never cease to mourn their own condition. There is a vast melancholy in the canticles of the wolves, melancholy infinite as the forest, endless as these long nights of winter. And yet that ghastly sadness, that mourning for their own irremediable appetites, can never move the heart, for not one phrase in it hints at the possibility of redemption. Grace could not come to the wolf from its own despair, only through some external mediator, so that sometimes the beast will look as if he half welcomes the knife that dispatches him. The young woman's brothers searched the outhouses and the haystacks, but never found any remains, so the sensible girl dried her eyes and found herself another husband, not too shy to piss into a pot, who spent the night indoors. She gave him a pair of bonny babies, and all went right as a trivet. Until, one freezing night, the night of the solstice, the hinge of the year when things do not fit together as well as they should, the longest night, her first good man came home again. A great thump on the door announced him as she was stirring the soup for the father of her children, and she knew him the moment she lifted the latch to him, although it was years since she'd worn black for him, and now he was in rags, and his hair hung down his back and never saw a comb, alive with lice.
"Here I am again, missus," he said. "Get me my bowl of cabbage, and be quick about it."
Then her second husband came in with wood for the fire, and when the first one saw she'd slept with another man, and, worse, clapped his red eyes on her little children who'd crept into the kitchen to see what all the din was about, he shouted,
"I wish I were a wolf again to teach this whore a lesson!"
So a wolf he instantly became, and he tore off the eldest boy's left foot before he was chopped up with a hatchet they used for chopping logs. But when the wolf lay bleeding and gasping its last, the pelt peeled off again, and he was just as he had been years ago when he ran away from his marriage bed, so that she wept and her second husband beat her. They say there's an ointment the devil gives you that turns you into a wolf the minute you rub it on. Or that he was born feet first and had a wolf for his father, and his torso is a man's, but his legs and genitals are a wolf's, and he has a wolf's heart. 7 years is a werewolf's natural span. But if you burn his human clothing, you condemn him to wolfishness for the rest of his life. So old wives hereabouts think it's some protection to throw a hat or an apron at the werewolf, as if clothes made the man. Yet by the eyes, those phosphorescent eyes, you know him in all his shapes, the eyes alone unchanged by metamorphosis. Before he can become a wolf, the lycanthrope strips stark naked. If you spy a naked man among the pines, you must run as if the devil were after you. It is midwinter, and the robin, the friend of man, sits on the handle of the gardener's spade and sings. It is the worst time in all the year for wolves, but this strong-minded child insists she will go off through the wood. She is quite sure the wild beasts cannot harm her, although, well warned, she lays a carving knife in the basket her mother has packed with cheeses. There is a bottle of harsh liquor distilled from brambles, a batch of flat oat cakes baked on the hearthstone, a pot or two of jam. The flaxen-haired girl will take these delicious gifts to a reclusive grandmother, so old the burden of her years is crushing her to death. Granny lives 2 hours' trudge through the winter woods. The child wraps herself up in her thick shawl, draws it over her head. She steps into her stout wooden shoes. She is dressed and ready, and it is Christmas Eve. The malign door of the solstice still swings upon its hinges, but she has been too much loved ever to feel scared. Children do not stay young for long in this savage country. There are no toys for them to play with, so they work hard and grow wise. But this one, so pretty and the youngest of her family, a little latecomer, had been indulged by her mother and the grandmother who'd knitted her the red shawl that, today, has the ominous, if brilliant, look of blood on snow. Her breasts have just begun to swell. Her hair is like lint, so fair it hardly makes a shadow on her pale forehead. Her cheeks are an emblematic scarlet and white, and she has just started her woman's bleeding, the clock inside her that will strike, henceforward, once a month. She stands and moves within the invisible pentacle of her own virginity. She is an unbroken egg. She is a sealed vessel. She has inside her a magic space, the entrance to which is shut tight with a plug of membrane. She is a closed system. She does not know how to shiver. She has a knife, and she is afraid of nothing. Her father might forbid her, if he were home, but he is away in the forest, gathering wood, and her mother cannot deny her. The forest closed upon her like a pair of jaws. There is always something to look at in the forest, even in the middle of winter. The huddled mounds of birds succumbed to the lethargy of the season, heaped on the creaking boughs and too forlorn to sing. The bright frills of the winter fungi on the blotched trunks of the trees, the cuneiform slots of rabbits and deer, the herringbone tracks of the birds, a hare as lean as a rasher of bacon, streaking across the path where the thin sunlight dapples the russet brakes of last year's bracken. When she heard the freezing howl of a distant wolf, her practiced hand sprang to the handle of her knife. But she saw no sign of a wolf at all, nor of a naked man, neither. But then she heard a clattering among the brushwood, and there sprang onto the path a fully clothed one, a very handsome young one, in the green coat and wide-awake hat of a hunter, laden with carcasses of game birds. She had her hand on her knife at the first rustle of twigs, but he laughed with a flash of white teeth when he saw her, and made her a comic yet flattering little bow. She'd never seen such a fine fellow before, not among the rustic clowns of her native village. So on they went together, through the thickening light of the afternoon. Soon they were laughing and joking like old friends. When he offered to carry her basket, she gave it to him, although her knife was in it, because he told her his rifle would protect them. As the day darkened, it began to snow again. She felt the first flakes settle on her eyelashes, but now there was only half a mile to go, and there would be a fire and hot tea and a welcome, a warm one, surely, for the dashing huntsman, as well as for herself. This young man had a remarkable object in his pocket. It was a compass. She looked at the little round glass face in the palm of his hand and watched the wavering needle with a vague wonder. He assured her this compass had taken him safely through the wood on his hunting trip because the needle always told him with perfect accuracy where the north was. She did not believe it. She knew she should never leave the path on the way through the wood, or else she would be lost instantly. He laughed at her again. Gleaming trails of spittle clung to his teeth. He said if he plunged off the path into the forest that surrounded them, he could guarantee to arrive at her grandmother's house a good quarter of an hour before she did, plotting his way through the undergrowth with his compass while she trudged the long way along the winding path. "I don't believe you. Besides, aren't you afraid of the wolves?" He only tapped the gleaming butt of his rifle and grinned.
"Is it a bet?" he asked her. "Shall we make a game of it? What will you give me if I get to your grandmother's house before you?"
"What would you like?" she asked disingenuously.
"A kiss."
Commonplaces of a rustic seduction, she lowered her eyes and blushed. He went through the undergrowth and took her basket with him, but she forgot to be afraid of the beasts, although now the moon was rising, for she wanted to dawdle on her way to make sure the handsome gentleman would win his wager. Grandmother's house stood by itself a little way out of the village. The freshly falling snow blew in eddies about the kitchen garden, and the young man stepped delicately up the snowy path to the door as if he were reluctant to get his feet wet, swinging his bundle of game and the girl's basket and humming a little tune to himself. There is a faint trace of blood on his chin. He has been snacking on his catch. Aged and frail, Granny's three-quarters succumbed to the mortality the ache in her bones promises her, and almost ready to give in entirely. A boy came out from the village to build up her hearth for the night an hour ago, and the kitchen crackles with busy firelight. She has her Bible for company. She is a pious old woman. She is propped up on several pillows in the bed, set into the wall peasant fashion, wrapped up in the patchwork quilt she made before she was married, more years ago than she cares to remember. Two China spaniels with liver-coloured blotches on their coats and black noses sit on either side of the fireplace. There is a bright rug of woven rags on the pantiles. The grandfather clock ticks away her eroding time. We keep the wolves outside by living well. He rapped upon the panels with his hairy knuckles.
It is your granddaughter,
he mimicked in a high soprano.
Lift up the latch and walk in, my darling.
You can tell them by their eyes, eyes of a beast of prey, nocturnal, devastating eyes as red as a wound. You can hurl your Bible at him and your apron after, Granny. You thought that was a sure prophylactic against these infernal vermin. Now call on Christ and his mother and all the angels in heaven to protect you, but it won't do you any good. His feral muzzle is sharp as a knife. He drops his golden burden of gnawed pheasant on the table and puts down your dear girl's basket too.
Oh my God, what have you done with her?
Off with his disguise, that coat of forest-coloured cloth, the hat with the feather tucked into the ribbon. His matted hair streams down his white shirt and she can see the lice moving in it. The sticks in the hearth shift and hiss. Night and the forest has come into the kitchen with darkness tangled in its hair. He strips off his shirt. His skin is the colour and texture of vellum. A crisp stripe of hair runs down his belly. His nipples are ripe and dark as poison fruit, but he's so thin you could count the ribs under his skin if only he gave you the time. He strips off his trousers, and she can see how hairy his legs are. His genitals, huge. Ah, huge. The last thing the old lady saw in all this world was a young man, eyes like cinders, naked as a stone, approaching her bed. The wolf is carnivore incarnate. When he had finished with her, he licked his chops and quickly dressed himself again, until he was just as he had been when he came through her door. He burned the inedible hair in the fireplace and wrapped the bones up in a napkin that he hid away under the bed in the wooden chest in which he found a clean pair of sheets. These he carefully put on the bed instead of the telltale stained ones he stowed away in the laundry basket. He plumped up the pillows and shook out the patchwork quilt. He picked up the Bible from the floor, closed it, and laid it on the table. All was as it had been before, except that grandmother was gone. The sticks twitched in the grate, the clock ticked, and the young man sat patiently, deceitfully beside the bed in Granny's nightcap. Rat-a-tap-tap.
Who's there?
He quavers in Granny's antique falsetto.
Only your granddaughter.
So she came in, bringing with her a flurry of snow that melted in tears on the tiles, and perhaps she was a little disappointed to see only her grandmother sitting beside the fire. But then he flung off the blanket and sprang to the door, pressing his back against it so that she could not get out again. The girl looked round the room and saw there was not even the indentation of a head on the smooth cheek of the pillow, and how, for the first time she'd seen it so, the Bible lay closed on the table. The tick of the clock cracked like a whip. She wanted her knife from her basket, but she did not dare reach for it because its eyes were fixed upon her. Huge eyes that now seemed to shine with a unique interior light, eyes the size of saucers, saucers full of Greek fire, diabolic phosphorescence.
What big eyes you have!
All the better to see you with. No trace at all of the old woman, except for a tuft of white hair that had caught in the bark of an unburned log. When the girl saw that, she knew she was in danger of death.
Where is my grandmother?
There's nobody here but we two, my darling. Now a great howling rose up all around them, near, very near, as close as the kitchen garden, the howling of a multitude of wolves. She knew the worst wolves are hairy on the inside, and she shivered, in spite of the scarlet shawl she pulled more closely round herself, as if it could protect her, although it was as red as the blood she must spill.
"Who has come to sing us carols?" she said.
"Those are the voices of my brothers, darling. I love the company of wolves. Look out the window and you'll see them." Snow half-caked the lattice, and she opened it to look into the garden. It was a white night of moon and snow. The blizzard whirled round the gaunt grey beasts who squatted on their haunches among the rows of winter cabbage, pointing their sharp snouts to the moon and howling as if their hearts would break. 10 wolves, 20 wolves, so many wolves she could not count them, howling in concert as if demented or deranged. Their eyes reflected the light from the kitchen and shone like 100 candles.
"It is very cold, poor things," she said. "No wonder they howl so."
She closed the window on the wolves' threnody and took off her scarlet shawl, the colour of poppies, the colour of sacrifices, the colour of her menses. And, since her fear did her no good, she ceased to be afraid.
"What shall I do with my shawl?"
"Throw it on the fire, dear one. You won't need it again." She bundled up her shawl and threw it on the blaze, which instantly consumed it. Then she drew her blouse over her head. Her small breasts gleamed as if the snow had invaded the room.
"What shall I do with my blouse?"
"Into the fire with it too, my pet." The thin muslin went flaring up the chimney like a magic bird, and now off came her skirt, her woolen stockings, her shoes, and onto the fire they went too, and were gone for good. The firelight shone through the edges of her skin. Now she was clothed only in her untouched integument of flesh. This dazzling, naked, she combed out her hair with her fingers. Her hair looked white as the snow outside. Then went directly to the man with red eyes, in whose unkempt mane the lice moved. She stood up on tiptoe and unbuttoned the collar of his shirt.
"What big arms you have."
"All the better to hug you with." Every wolf in the world now howled a prothelemian outside the window as she freely gave the kiss she owed him.
"What big teeth you have."
She saw how his jaw began to slaver, and the room was full of the clamour of the forest's Liebestod, but the wise child never flinched, even when he answered, "All the better to eat you with." The girl burst out laughing. She knew she was nobody's meat. She laughed at him full in the face. She ripped off his shirt for him and flung it into the fire, in the fiery wake of her own discarded clothing. The flames danced like dead souls on Walpurgisnacht, and the old bones under the bed set up a terrible clattering, but she did not pay them any heed. Carnivore incarnate, only immaculate flesh appeases him. She will lay his fearful head on her lap, and she will pick out the lice from his pelt, and perhaps she will put the lice into her mouth and eat them, as he will bid her, as she would do in a savage marriage ceremony. The blizzard will die down. The blizzard died down, leaving the mountains as randomly covered with snow as if a blind woman had thrown a sheet over them. The upper branches of the forest pines limed, creaking, swollen with the fall. Snowlight, moonlight, a confusion of paw prints. All silent, all still. Midnight, and the clock strikes. It is Christmas Day, the werewolf's birthday. The door of the solstice stands wide open. Let them all sink through. See? Sweet and sound, she sleeps in Granny's bed, between the paws of the tender wolf.
Wolf Alice. Could this ragged girl, with brindled lugs, have spoken like we do, she would have called herself a wolf. But she cannot speak, although she howls because she is lonely. Yet howl is not the right word for it, since she is young enough to make the noise that pups do, bubbling, delicious, like that of a panful of fat on the fire. Sometimes the sharp ears of her foster kindred hear her across the irreparable gulf of absence. They answer her from faraway pine forest and the bald mountain rim. Their counterpoint crosses and crisscrosses the night sky. They are trying to talk to her, but they cannot do so because she does not understand their language, even if she knows how to use it, for she is not a wolf herself, although suckled by wolves. Her panting tongue hangs out. Her red lips are thick and fresh. Her legs are long, lean, and muscular. Her elbows, hands, and knees are thickly calloused because she always runs on all fours. She never walks. She trots or gallops. Her pace is not our pace. Two legs looks. Four legs sniffs. Her long nose is always a quiver, sifting every scent it meets. With this useful tool, she lengthily investigates everything she glimpses. She can net so much more of the world than we can through the fine, hairy, sensitive filters of her nostrils that her poor eyesight does not trouble her. Her nose is sharper by night than our eyes are by day, so it is the night she prefers, when the cool, reflected light of the moon does not make her eyes smart and draws out the various fragrances from the woodland where she wanders when she can. But the wolves keep well away from the peasants' shotguns now, and she will no longer find them there. Wide shoulders, long arms, and she sleeps succinctly curled into a ball as if she were cradling her spine in her tail. Nothing about her is human except that she is not a wolf. It is as if the fur she thought she wore had melted into her skin and become part of it, although it does not exist. Like the wild beasts, she lives without a future. She inhabits only the present tense, a fugue of the continuous, a world of sensual immediacy, as without hope as it is without despair. When they found her in the wolf's den beside the bullet-riddled corpse of her foster mother, she was no more than a little brown scrap so snarled in her own brown hair, they did not at first think she was a child, but a cub. She snapped at her would-be saviors with her spiky canines, until they tied her up by force. She spent her first days amongst us, crouched stock still, staring at the whitewashed wall of her cell in the convent to which they took her. The nuns poured water over her, poked her with sticks to rouse her. Then she might snatch bread from their hands and race with it into a corner to mumble it with her back towards them. It was a great day among the novices when she learned to sit up on her hind legs and beg for a crust. They found that if she were treated with a little kindness, she was not intractable. She learned to recognize her own dish, then, to drink from a cup. They found that she could quite easily be taught a few simple tricks, But she did not feel the cold, and it took a long while to wheedle a shift over her head to cover up her bold nakedness. Yet she always seemed wild, impatient of restraint, capricious in temper. When the Mother Superior tried to teach her to give thanks for her recovery from the wolves, she arched her back, pawed the floor, retreated to a far corner of the chapel, crouched, trembled, urinated, defecated, reverted entirely, it would seem, to her natural state. Therefore, without a qualm, this 9 days' wonder and continuing embarrassment of a child was delivered over to the bereft and unsanctified household of the Duke. Deposited at the castle, she huffed and snuffed and smelled only a reek of meat, not the least whiff of sulphur, nor of familiarity. She settled down on her hunkers with that dog's sigh that is only the expulsion of breath and does not mean either relief or resignation. The Duke is sere as old paper. His dry skin rustles against the bed sheets as he throws them back to thrust out his thin legs scabbed with old scars where thorns scored his pelt. He lives in a gloomy mansion, all alone but for this child, who has as little in common with the rest of us as he does. His bedroom is painted terracotta, rusted with a wash of paint, like the interior of an Iberian butcher's shop. But for himself, nothing can hurt him since he ceased to cast an image in the mirror. He sleeps in an antlered bed of dull black wrought iron until the moon, the governess of transformations and overseer of somnambulists, pokes an imperative finger through the narrow window and strikes his face. Then his eyes start open. At night, those huge, inconsolable, rapacious eyes of his are eaten up by swollen, gleaming pupils. His eyes see only appetite. These eyes open to devour the world in which he sees nowhere a reflection of himself. He passed through the mirror and now, henceforward, lives as if upon the other side of things. Spilt, glistering milk of moonlight, on the frost, crisped grass, on such a night, in moony, metaphoric weather, they say you might easily find him, if you had been foolish enough to venture out late, scuttling along by the churchyard wall, with half a juicy torso slung across his back. The white light scours the fields, and scours them again until everything gleams, and he will leave paw prints in the hoar frost, when he runs howling round the graves at night in his lupine fiestas. By the red early hour of midwinter sunset, all the doors are barred for miles. The cows low fretfully in the byre. When he goes by, the whimpering dogs sink their noses in their paws. He carries on his frail shoulders a weird burden of fear. He is cast in the role of the corpse-eater, the body-snatcher, who invades the last privacies of the dead. He is white as leprosy, with scrabbling fingernails, and nothing deters him. If you stuff a corpse with garlic, why, he only slavers at the treat. Cadaver Provençal. He will use the Holy Cross as a scratching post, and crouch above the font to thirstily lap up holy water. She sleeps in the soft, warm ashes of the hearth. Beds are traps. She will not stay in one. She can perform the few small tasks to which the nuns trained her. She sweeps up the hairs, vertebrae and phalanges that litter his room into a dustpan. She makes up his bed at sunset when he leaves it, and the grey beasts outside howl as if they know his transformation is their parody. Unkind to their prey, to their own they are tender. Had the Duke been a wolf, they would have angrily expelled him from the pack. He would have had to lollop along miles behind them, creeping in submission on his belly up to the kill only after they had eaten and were sleeping, to gnaw the well-chewed bones and chew the hide. Yet suckled as she was by wolves on the high uplands where her mother bore and left her, only his kitchen maid, who is not wolf or woman, knows no better than to do his chores for him. She grew up with wild beasts. If you could transport her in her filth, rags, and feral disorder to the Eden of our first beginnings where Eve and grunting Adam squat on a daisy bank, picking the lice from one another's pelts, then she might prove to be the wise child who leads them all, and her silence and her howling a language as authentic as any language of nature. In a world of talking beasts and flowers, she would be the bud of flesh in the kind lion's mouth. But how can the bitten apple flesh out its scar again? Mutilation is her lot. Though now and then she will emit an involuntary rustle of sound, as if the unused chords in her throat were a wind harp that moved with the random impulses of the air, her whisper more obscure than the voices of the dumb. Familiar desecrations in the village graveyard. The coffin had been ripped open with the abandon with which a child unwraps a gift on Christmas morning, and of its contents, not a trace could be found but for a rag of the bridal veil in which the corpse had been wrapped that was caught fluttering in the brambles at the churchyard gate, so they knew which way he had taken it, towards his gloomy castle. In the lapse of time, the trance of being of that exiled place, this girl grew amongst things she could neither name nor perceive. How did she think? How did she feel? This perennial stranger with her furred thoughts and her primal sentience that existed in a flux of shifting impressions. There are no words to describe the way she negotiated the abyss between her dreams, those wakings strange as her sleepings. The wolves had tended her because they knew she was an imperfect wolf. We secluded her in animal privacy out of fear of her imperfection because it showed us what we might have been. And so time passed, although she scarcely knew it. Then she began to bleed. Her first blood bewildered her. She did not know what it meant, and the first stirrings of surmise that ever she felt were directed towards its possible cause. The moon had been shining into the kitchen when she woke to feel the trickle between her thighs, and it seemed to her that a wolf who, perhaps, was fond of her, as wolves were, and who lived, perhaps, in the moon, must have nibbled her cunt while she was sleeping, had subjected her to a series of affectionate nips, too gentle to wake her, yet sharp enough to break the skin. The shape of this theory was blurred yet. Out of it, there took root a kind of wild reasoning, as it might have from a seed dropped in her brain off the foot of a flying bird. The flow continued for a few days, which seemed to her an endless time. She had, as yet, no direct notion of past, or of future, or of duration, only of a dimensionless, immediate moment. At night, she prowled the empty house looking for rags to sop the blood up. She had learned a little elementary hygiene in the convent, enough to know how to bury her excrement and cleanse herself of her natural juices, although the nuns had not the means to inform her how it should be. It was not fastidiousness, but shame that made her do so. She found towels, sheets, and pillowcases in closets that had not been opened since the Duke came shrieking into the world with all his teeth to bite his mother's nipple off and weep. She found once-worn ball dresses in cobwebbed wardrobes, and heaped in the corners of his bloody chamber, shrouds, nightdresses, and burial clothes that had wrapped items on the Duke's menus. She tore strips of the most absorbent fabrics to clumsily diaper herself. In the course of these prowlings, she bumped against that mirror over whose surface the Duke passed like a wind on ice. First, she tried to nuzzle her reflection. Then, nosing it industriously, she soon realized it gave out no smell. She bruised her muzzle on the cold glass and broke her claws trying to tussle with this stranger. She saw with irritation, then amusement, how it mimicked every gesture of hers when she raised her forepaw to scratch herself, or dragged her bum along the dusty carpet to rid herself of a slight discomfort in her hind quarters. She rubbed her head against her reflected face to show that she felt friendly towards it, and felt a cool, solid, immovable surface between herself and she, some kind, possibly, of invisible cage. In spite of this barrier, she was lonely enough to ask this creature to try to play with her, baring her teeth and grinning. At once, she received a reciprocal invitation. She rejoiced. She began to whirl round on herself, yapping exultantly. But when she retreated from the mirror, she halted in the midst of her ecstasy, puzzled to see how her new friend grew less in size. The moonlight spilled into the Duke's motionless bedroom from behind a cloud, and she saw how pale this wolf, not wolf, who played with her was. The moon and mirrors have this much in common. You cannot see behind them. Moonlit and white, Wolf Alice looked at herself in the mirror and wondered whether there she saw the beast who came to bite her in the night. Then her sensitive ears pricked at the sound of a step in the hall. Trotting at once back to her kitchen, she encountered the Duke with the leg of a man over his shoulder. Her toenails clicked against the stairs as she padded incuriously past. She, the serene, inviolable one in her absolute and verminous innocence. Soon the flow ceased. She forgot it. The moon vanished, but little by little reappeared. When it again visited her kitchen at full strength, Wolf Alice was surprised into bleeding again. And so it went on, with a punctuality that transformed her vague grip on time. She learned to expect these bleedings, to prepare her rags against them, and afterwards neatly to bury the dirtied things. Sequence asserted itself with custom. And then she understood the circumambulatory principle of the clock perfectly. Even if all clocks were banished from the den where she and the Duke inhabited their separate solitudes, so that you might say she discovered the very action of time by means of this returning cycle. When she curled up among the cinders, the color, texture, and warmth of them brought her foster mother's belly out of the past and printed it on her flesh. Her first conscious memory, painful as the first time the nuns combed her hair. She howled a little, in a firmer, deepening trajectory, to obtain the inscrutable consolation of the wolf's response, for now the world around her was assuming form. She perceived an essential difference between herself and her surroundings that you might say she could not put her finger on. Only the trees and grass of the meadows outside no longer seemed the emanation of her questing nose and erect ears, and yet sufficient to itself, but a kind of backdrop for her that waited for her arrivals to give it meaning. She saw herself upon it, and her eyes, with their somber clarity, took on a veiled, introspective look. She would spend hours examining the new skin that had been born, it seemed to her, of her bleeding. She would lick her soft upholstery with her long tongue and groom her hair with her fingernails. She examined her new breasts with curiosity. The white growths reminded her of nothing so much as the night-sprung puffballs she had found, sometimes on evening rambles in the woods, a natural, if disconcerting, apparition. But then to her astonishment, she found a little diadem of fresh hairs tufting between her thighs. She showed it to her mirror littermate, who reassured her by showing her she shared it. The damned Duke haunts the graveyard. He believes himself to be both less and more than a man, as if his obscene difference were a sign of grace. During the day, he sleeps. His mirror faithfully reflects his bed, but never the meager shape within the disordered covers. Sometimes, on those white nights when she was left alone in the house, she dragged out his grandmother's ball dresses and rolled on suave velvet and abrasive lace because to do so delighted her adolescent skin. Her intimate in the mirror wound the old clothes round herself, wrinkling its nose in delight at the ancient yet still potent scents of musk and civet that woke up in the sleeves and bodices. This habitual, at last boring fidelity to her every movement finally woke her up to the regretful possibility that her companion was, in fact, no more than a particularly ingenious variety of the shadow she cast on sunlit grass. Had not she and the rest of the litter tousled and romped with their shadows long ago? She poked her agile nose around the back of the mirror. She found only dust, a spider stuck in his web, a heap of rags. A little moisture leaked from the corners of her eyes, yet her relation with the mirror was now far more intimate, since she knew she saw herself within it. She poured and tumbled the dress the Duke had tucked away behind the mirror for a while. The dust was soon shaken out of it. She experimentally inserted her front legs in the sleeves. Although the dress was torn and crumpled, it was so white and of such a sinuous texture that she thought, before she put it on, she must thoroughly wash off her coat of ashes in the water from the pump in the yard, which she knew how to manipulate with her cunning forepaw. In the mirror, she saw how this white dress made her shine. Although she could not run so fast on two legs in petticoats, she trotted out in her new dress to investigate the odorous October hedgerows, like a debutante from the castle, delighted with herself but still now and then singing to the wolves with a kind of wistful triumph, because now she knew how to wear clothes, and so had put on the visible sign of her difference from them. Her footprints on damp earth are beautiful and menacing as those Man Friday left. The young husband of the dead bride spent a long time planning his revenge. He filled the church with an arsenal of bells, books, and candles, a battery of silver bullets. They brought a 10-gallon tub of holy water in a wagon from the city, where it had been blessed by the Archbishop himself to drown the Duke if the bullets bounced off him. They gathered in the church to chant a litany and wait for the one who would visit with the first deaths of winter. She goes out at night more often now. The landscape assembles itself about her. She informs it with her presence. She is its significance. It seemed to her the congregation in the church was ineffectually attempting to imitate the wolves' chorus. She lent them the assistance of her own educated voice for a while, rocking contemplatively on her haunches by the graveyard gate. Then her nostrils twitched to catch the rank stench of the dead that told her her cohabitor was at hand. Raising her head, who did her new keen eyes spy, but the Lord of Cobweb Castle intent on performing his cannibal rituals. And if her nostrils flare suspiciously at the choking reek of incense, and his do not, that is because she is far more sentient than he. She will therefore run, run, when she hears the crack of bullets, because they killed her foster mother. So with the self-same lilting lope, drenched with holy water, will he run too, until the young widower fires the silver bullet that bites his shoulder and drags off half his fictive pelt, so that he must rise up like any common forked biped and limp, distressfully, on as best he may. When they saw the white bride leap out of the tombstones and scamper off towards the castle with the werewolf stumbling after, The peasants thought the Duke's dearest victim had come back to take matters into her own hands. They ran screaming from the presence of a ghostly vengeance on him. Poor, wounded thing. Locked half and half between such strange states. An aborted transformation. An incomplete mystery. Now he lies writhing on his black